A week from tonight, a very special event will be happening August 13th at Shakespeare & Company. Maureen O'Flynn and John Cheek, leading singers from the Metropolitan Opera, among others, will be performing the first performance of new opera Pearl, which is a modern retelling of The Scarlet Letter from the viewpoint of the daughter Hester Prynne. The project was initiated by the conductor Sarah Jobin, a Berkshire resident and the first woman to conduct the San Francisco Opera. The composer is Amy Scuria, and the libretto written by Carol Gilligan and her son Jonathan Gilligan, based on her play, The Scarlet Letter, which was commissioned and produced by Shakespeare & Company in 2002. Joining us this morning, we welcome Carol Gilligan, Sarah Jobin, and Maureen Flynn to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So let us begin with how all of this came together. And I guess since the project was initiated by Sarah Jobin, we will begin there.
Wow. Well, it's such a privilege to be here. Thank you for having us. And, you know, honestly, it came out of my dreams. At a certain point, as an opera conductor, I got sick of conducting operas where the woman goes, help me, and then she dies, which is most of opera. There's a lot of really beautiful music to that story, but I'm tired of that story, so I started a repertoire project where we would do operas with a different story, particularly with female characters who are strong and inspirational. So long story short, contacted Carol Gilligan, started the Different Voice Opera Project, and then turned out that Carol had been working on this play already for 6 years, and she wanted to turn it into an opera.
Hmm.
So thus, Pearl was born.
I want to talk about that journey from play to opera in just a moment, but I don't want to let the your comments about the same old story going. I mean, the operas that we're very familiar with, while beautiful, and as you say, we have an amazing repertoire, but it is rather formulaic.
Yeah, she always dies. Well, and she always dies a victim of society, you know.
So what if?
Well, what if she could fight back? What if she could? I mean,
what if there was a story that wasn't about the victimization of women, and more to the point, the success and the strength of a woman? I mean, if Sarah's sick of it, you can only imagine how tired I am. I mean, I actually had somebody follow me to Spain, and he came to the dressing room door. I said, "What are you doing here?" And he said, "I needed to come to an opera where you didn't die." And it was Pearl Fisher's, which is a stretch. Anyway, she doesn't die, but sometimes you wonder why they don't die at the end of that. But I think because it was old-time stories, we're talking, you know, 1700s, 1800s, when most of the really great ones were written. And it is formulaic, for a lot of the stories are, you know, epic stories of great, important people and some poor woman being victimized and somehow having an impact, but dying as she does.
And it's beautiful music. I love conducting that music. But also, there's something that happens in an opera house when we repeat these stories again and again and again with beautiful music that makes our heart, you know, soar. We get attached to those stories, and we start repeating those stories, actually. I think there's something cultural, like
Well, you legitimize the practice a bit, right?
Yeah, you like go over the same groove again and again and again. You get deeper into that groove. And like, I just want to get out of that groove.
So enter Carol Gilligan. And Carol, how much of that was a conscious effort on your part to say, yes, this is a problem with opera and I would like to add something to the repertoire to change it?
Well, Joe, it was totally unconscious.
Yeah. I mean, well,
not at all conscious. In fact, what happened was I was doing this research at the time on girls, and a friend of mine said to me, "Have you read Scarlet Letter?" And I remembered Scarlet Letter as exactly what Maureen and Sarah were just talking about a book, a novel, Hawthorne's novel about the wages of sin and tragic love, that at the end she dies. And they're buried next to each
too.
Other. Yeah, but they're buried next to each other, so it's very romantic. I'm sure you could write. And she said, no, read it again. And I saw a book that absolutely astonished me, particularly because here's The Scarlet Letter. It's in my mind now the great American novel. It's in the middle of the American tradition, and you have this strong woman character, Hester Prynne. And she, at the end of the novel, she frees her daughter, Pearl. She takes Pearl out of this puritanical community to England, where she can lead a life, and she goes back, Hester goes back to Boston, and she tells people who come to her for counsel and comfort of her belief. She says her firm belief that when the world has grown ripe for it in heaven's own time, a new truth will be revealed in order to establish the whole relation between man and woman on a surer ground of mutual happiness. And this woman is a prophetess. I mean, A, in the novel, the word adultery is never mentioned. We're told halfway through that many people said the A meant Abel, so strong was Hester Prynne with a woman's strength. A means angel, A means apostle. We have an aria in the opera about A. What does the A mean? And this is, and what was fascinating for me is I had assimilated this novel to that old story, the old tragic love story. And that's not what this novel is. So it's so about an inner world of registering truth, kind of almost on a vibrational level and emotionally, that after doing the play, both Tina Packer and I agreed that to have music, I mean, to do it as an opera, this would be the best possible form in which to tell the story, which strikes me as an incredibly contemporary story right now, because it's about the relationships between men and women. It's about religion and the meaning of religion. It's also about what it means to create a democratic society. I mean, the themes that are so current. So the opera is a story told from the point of view of the child, Pearl, now grown up. She's a woman. She herself has a daughter. And it's really about what truths do we pass down, particularly from parents to children, from mothers to daughters. And Hester Prynne is exactly the woman Sarah was looking for, this incredibly strong woman, really charismatic, visionary woman character.
At what point did you, because you've been now, obviously you've been working on a lot of other things in the process, but over 10 years you've been working, this has been a journey for 10 years.
This has been a journey. This has been an incredible journey, and my thanks, and we're doing this as a benefit for Shakespeare and Company, but really to honor Tina Packer and her encouragement of other women artists to do. And she was the one who said to me, you've written about The Scarlet Letter. Why don't you turn it into a play? Mm. And I hadn't written a play before. You know, and I think sometimes because I went to progressive school, somebody says, do something. And you think, oh, sure.
Well, Carol can do this. She can do anything.
And so, you know, the development, it was an incredible thing, you know, for a writer who tends to work alone, to work with actors.
Yeah.
And then to move it into opera and to work with Sarah and to work with Amy, the composer.
Amy Scurria.
At Amy Scurria, and then now to work with Maureen and singers of Maureen's caliber. I mean, I just, you know, I have to pinch myself that this is happening.
Me too.
So in that process, Sarah, when you first, were you working with Carol, or did you just receive sort of a finished product and said, here it is, or was it a collaborative?
No, it's been collaborative for 3 years. So Carol and her son Jonathan have been working on this play now, workshopping it for 10 years.
Well, it's been, right? Actually, the play was, scenes from the play were part of the Hawthorne Bicentennial, yes, at Tanglewood with Marissa Tomei as Hester and David Strathairn as Dimmesdale. I mean, and then both Marissa, then we went to New York and we did a reading of the play at the Judson Church as an anti-inauguration event in 2004, saying the Puritans are back. And then, but then we did it at the Culture Project.
I love you.
The Puritans are back. The Puritans are back.
Okay. Great idea. All right.
And then we did it at the Culture Project with Marissa. And so it's been an incredible, like, learning curve for me, and this amazing, really, I feel very privileged to be part of this project. And then Sarah came along, and Sarah calls me out of the blue or emails me and says, my dream is to do a project with you. I think, oh, how nice. And then she says, and I want to take you out of your comfort zone. I thought, really? You know? And so she's, that's how this started. And so we started talking, and we both thought,
Well, and it's been 3 years now. So then we started with this idea, and then we found Amy Scurria, and we both really liked her music. So we asked her to be the composer. And that was 3 years ago. And then we've had like monthly conference calls for 3 years.
The four of us.
We've all been collaborating over a period of 3 years. And now the singers have been brought in now just the last 2 months. We've been preparing all the music and had our first full rehearsal 2 days ago, which was great.
I want to just quickly talk about the comfort zone issue. And while I certainly understand the point of taking you out of your comfort zone, is writing with your son a bit of being in a comfort zone?
That's a lovely question, because the answer is yes. Mm. And I realized, and as we started doing it, the way it happened was the play was read as part of a Brandeis in the Berkshire seminar in the summer of 2003. And at the reading, which was directed by Normie Noel, the next morning in that Brandeis in the Berkshire seminar was a feedback, and my son Jonathan happened to be there. And his comments were incredible. So afterwards, I said, Jonathan, he's my oldest son. I said, Jonathan, your comments were terrific. They were so helpful. And he said to me, Mom, I see what you're trying to do, and I think I can help you. So I said, great. And then we started working together.
Which has to make you enormously proud and ticked off at the same time.
That'd be both. I mean, wonderful mixture.
He's a wonderful poet.
He's an incredible poet, and a lot of the poetry in the opera is his poetry. And then I remembered, as a child, because he understood the physical world, we would do all kinds of things together. Like, I was interested in doing an organic garden, but if you show me a rototiller, I mean, and he figured out how to do these things. So we had worked together. And it's very easy for us to work together. We work together fast. We disagree openly. It's really been a joy, and a joy for me too, to see the poet side of him just flourishing again.
Let me get back to for a moment with Maureen O'Flynn, because as you mentioned, you have the standard repertoire. So, is it rare for you to get something new?
Yes. Yeah.
And so when you're presented with something like this, where you, and I assume have input, right?
Well, that's one of the beauties of being in on this from the ground up, because, and also working with people who, and first and foremost, are collaborative, because it's about the piece. It's not about anybody's ego. It doesn't seem to me at this point. There's collaboration from Amy, the composer, who's willing to hear what we as singers have to say about what's possible, what's not possible vocally, what we need to be able to sing a line in a certain expression. We get to talk about that with Amy, and also to talk about plot and character twists and character developments with Carol. So it's really like being part of the birth. It's very, very exciting, and it's very gratifying, and it's a tremendous learning curve for all of us. No matter how much of this kind of stuff that you do, it's always a learning curve to be with someone who's putting in their eggs from their basket, the writer's basket, the composer's basket, Hawthorne's basket, me, the singer, the other singers. It's a real potpourri of all kinds of creativity, so it's immensely exciting.
And I have to say how grateful we all are to have singers of the caliber of Maureen O'Flynn and John Cheek also, especially collaborating on this project, because it's a real privilege for all of us, including the composer. I know I can speak for Amy Scurria, just that it's an amazing thing for us to be working with these guys.
When you are, I assume it's always this case of somewhat of a balance between telling the story and the musicality of it, but even more so in a case like this.
Well, I think that if I understand your question correctly, it is more so in a case like this because it's brand new and nobody else has done it before. There's no traditions.
For all the reasons that we mentioned before.
Yes, exactly. in the best of worlds, this kind of collaboration happens even with standard pieces. Mm. Because the standard genius pieces, the masterpieces, are never fully tilled. It's always a new exploration and a new revelation, depending on who you're doing it with. You yourself have changed. If you're doing a role you've done for 100 times, you're looking at different pairs of eyes, you're working with a different director, life experience has happened to you, to them, it changes everything. So that element hopefully exists always, but it never exists like it does when you're part of that first creation.
Carol, when you start something like this and you say, okay, this is what I want to do with The Scarlet Letter, is there an immediate concern of, well, I don't want to screw around with Hawthorne too much?
You know, I never had that thought.
You I go, thought,
Carol. Well, that's good. Because you want to tell a different story.
What I thought is, I was astonished that Hawthorne had written this in 1850. I thought, wow. And he wrote it. As a child, Hawthorne saw his mother scorned. And he wrote this in the 6 months after his mother's death, this novel, it's really like in a flash of lightning. He saw something and he captured it. And he never did anything like this again. And I actually was very encouraged that this was so in our tradition, so much about tensions that seem to me still very alive in American society. So what I didn't want to do was just simply like put Hawthorne to music or something. First of all, I'm not. But I was fascinated by the child in the novel, and Hawthorne had a six-year-old daughter at the time he wrote the novel. So Pearl is observed. She's the only one who sees the truth. She knows that the minister is her father when nobody else can see it, what the Puritans can't see, what nobody can see, she sees it. So I thought, who is this child going to be when she grows up? What understanding as a woman will she come to of who was her mother and who was her father and these events which she witnessed as a seven-year-old? What sense will she make of it as an adult, and particularly as now herself the mother of a daughter? Because I'm really interested in what stories, especially as women, we pass down to our daughters, what we do say, what we don't say. Mm. And the issue for Hester is Pearl sees the truth, but it's too dangerous in that place for her to say it. So Hester has to walk this very fine line about supporting this incredible child and yet keeping her safe so she's not going to be taken away. And I was saying to Maureen this morning, the amazing accomplishment of Hester. She can't free Dimmesdale. He goes back, her lover, but she frees her daughter. And I think that's just huge under these circumstances. And so, as I imagine, Pearl, who would this child be who saw so much as a child? Who would she grow up to be but couldn't say what she saw? She'd be a writer. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a recipe for a writer. Mm-hmm. And so I imagine adult Pearl as a writer, and she's the one who's going to wrestle with these questions, which to my mind are still in our midst and still unresolved, about we're a country committed to a vision of a democratic society, and yet there is that still Hawthorne's word, patriarchal privilege, patriarchal power. Did you know that he uses that word in the Scarlet Letter? So the tension between the vision of a democratic society and the continuation of patriarchal privilege and power, and the contradiction between this radical Protestant vision of an unmediated relationship with God who can be worshipped by anyone, anywhere, I mean, without anyone between you and God, and the continuation of an all-male clerical hierarchy. So look at these issues. What could be more current?
I ask the question because it seems as you come to this, both Hawthorne and the story with reverence.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm in awe of what Hawthorne has accomplished in this novel.
I'm also curious as to, because you used several times in the course of our conversation about how we as a culture and how we as women, and I'm curious if do you ever replace that with I? of looking at your own
story?
I mean, does it come down to a very fundamental psychological level sometimes?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I really appreciate that question.
For every female on the planet.
Yes.
Yeah.
I would say I. Yes.
Yeah.
And I struggle with these issues. I struggle with it in my own life. What do I know that I can actually know that I know and say what
what values to pass on?
What values? Mm-hmm. What that I know? Do I feel that I pass on to my not only my sons but my daughters-in-law, my grandchildren? You know.
And so it really does become an exploration for you and
for me,
and for us.
And where am I in this society as an American? You know, who's born in this country, and I mean, in terms of the core, the values that I believe in, the core democratic values, and the assault that they're under.
And what do I know in myself and, you know, my relationship with God that has nothing to do with a male religious hierarchy?
Mm-hmm. Mm. I mean, the epiphany in the opera, and it's such an operatic line. I mean, it was in the play, but it almost calls out to be in operas. If God is love, how can love be sin?
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And that, rehearsals must be heavy as hell. I can't even.
Well, no, they're really not. We only had the one rehearsal so far where we've all been together.
Remember,
where we've all actually heard each other, and it was revelatory. But I just want to say that I think what's happened here, and I've only just entered into this, and we've only just entered into discussion now that we're all finally together, because we've been working in our own little microcosms of learning music. Carol has really pretty much left the story for the most part as it is in the book, and I don't think that it's a different interpretation, or maybe rather to the point, it's an interpretation from a woman's point of view of exactly this, of what Hawthorne wrote. It's just Carol's bringing to it a female perspective of it, but Hawthorne actually wrote it. It is actually,
you see,
pro female in some respects.
Well, but it's saying that this is not something that only women know.
Exactly.
This is something we all know.
This is cultural.
I know it.
That's right.
It's an amazing, what you're all three of you, what the whole group of you are doing is absolutely amazing. And unfortunately, we're out of time, but I do want to let people know that Pearl, a contemporary retelling of Hawthorne's Scarlet Letter, it will take place, the performance will take place Monday, August 13th on the Tina Packer stage at Shakespeare & Company. Go to shakespeare.org for more information. It is a benefit. And shakespeare.org for more information. My thanks to Maureen O'Flynn, Sarah Jobin, and of course Carol Gilligan. The three of you are just amazing, and I thank you so much for sharing with us this morning.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.